Look up idiot in the dictionary, you know what you'll find?
A picture of me?
No! The definition of the word idiot, which you fucking are!
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to I Do Movies Badly, a podcast exploration of my cinematic ignorance. I am your host, Jim Rohner, and despite being an amateur film critic since 2006, I am woefully ignorant of many films, filmmakers, and genres that consensus has deemed important, and thus I have created this podcast to document my journey into cinematic edification. This month, I'm exploring the films of John Carpenter, as recommended by Reed Lackey, and this week's episode, I'll be talking about Carpenter's second feature-length film, the original Assault on Precinct 13. Let's just start out with the obvious, shall we? Let's just get the obvious stuff out of the way, because I'm not the first one to have said this, I won't be the last one to have said this, but of course, Assault on Precinct 13 is incredibly reminiscent of films like Night of the Living Dead, which came before, and many classic westerns, from what I've read, Rio Bravo being the one that is the most typifying of that, or the one that is the most heavily homaged or referenced. I have to rely on other people saying that, because honestly, I haven't seen Rio Bravo. Certainly looking back on, or not even looking back, but seeing a lot of filmmakers that John Carpenter loves and was influenced by has opened up a few months more of potential I Do Movies Badly episodes, because I haven't seen anything from Howard Hawks, I haven't seen anything from John Huston, I haven't seen anything from John Ford, and holy crap, after hearing that, why would you have any more cause to listen to me when I have when I am further emphasizing how woefully oblivious of cinema's past I really am? But I'll just say that. The very first thing I was reminded of when I was watching Assault on Precinct 13 was Night of the Living Dead. Night of the Living Dead is one of my favorite movies of all time, one of the most influential horror movies of all time, in my opinion, and one of my earliest horror memories was watching Night of the Living Dead. I don't remember the context, I don't remember what house I lived in, I don't remember how we got on there. I think it was just kind of really flipping through the channels, but I was reminded of... Not reminded, but my memory has me kind of coming across the scene near the end after kind of the shit has hit the fan, and Dwayne Jones's character is sort of on his own trying to fight off what is, you know, in the 1960s version, kind of a horde of not descending zombies, but zombies, you know, kind of encroaching on him as he's outside. And I just remember, and I don't remember anything else, but I remember seeing that image, and I remember how much that image stuck with me. And of course, that led me into rediscovering the film later on, and I wrote a paper in college about Night of the Living Dead, and about its social and political significance coming out in the 1960s. And so, that being one of my favorite films of all time, was of course very much reminded of that idea of a small group of motley survivors kind of stuck in a small claustrophobic space that have to fight off this horde of faceless, of identityless masses, and that's to Carpenter's credit, because the way that he directs this movie, the way that he depicts these characters, it very much is a faceless, anonymous, mass that is descending upon this little last vestige of civilization and hope and safety, I might as well just put it out there. Assault on Precinct 13 is okay. It's a fine film. I didn't really love it. I didn't really hate it. It just sort of... I don't want to say it just sort of was. That is me selling it short. But I guess there was a certain expectation that I would be really impressed or really blown away by Assault on Precinct 13. And I'm not sure why that is. Reed certainly did a good job selling it. Reed did a wonderful job of talking about John Carpenter, of selling John Carpenter. I hope that you enjoyed the introductory episode. I know I certainly did. But I don't know. I don't know what I was expecting with Assault on Precinct 13. I was certainly... I don't know. This is weird. I guess maybe I was expecting something a little bit... And this is weird. This is a weird comment, I must say. You know, not to take away from a film. But I guess I was expecting something a little bit more rough. A little bit something a little bit more bare bones and kind of a difficult viewing experience. And this is weird. Credit to John Carpenter. How well made and how well put together and how well directed Assault on Precinct 13 is. And I know that it's weird for me saying that I'm like, I was expecting something a little bit grittier, and what I got was something a little bit more polished, and that's a knock against the film. I'm not saying that. I'm more saying I don't know if my expectations were oriented properly to what I was about to get myself into, which is something I've talked about before in the show and something that I'm sure will continue to be somewhat of a weird skew and perhaps you can call it a problem moving forward. But hopefully if you've stuck with me through 99 episodes, yes, I just realized today as I was recording this, the next episode won't be my pure 100th episode. I've done bonus episodes and things like that, but in terms of the episodes that I have been numbering, next one is going to be 100. So if you've stuck with me through over 100 episodes, hopefully you know the ins and outs and the things that make me tick at this point. So hopefully you're not turned off by it. But let me start on the positive stuff, because like I said, Carpenter shows, for this being only his second feature film and the first one he is sort of directing on his own, and the first one that he is written and directed entirely by himself, there is an impressive display of command, of knowing what he wants to shoot, of knowing how he wants to craft his scenes and how he wants to build his story. And I'm thinking specifically of the usage of the wide angle, I believe, the wide aspect ratio, I believe, and feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, I believe that it was shot in a 2.35:1 aspect ratio, which is very widescreen, which is sort of weird and counterintuitive. You don't expect a wide aspect ratio to be featured in a film which is going to largely focus on a group of people stuck inside one small kind of claustrophobic space. But the fact that he shoots it wide, especially before, you know, in the build-up to the shootout, to the action sequences inside the police precinct, the usage of that wide aspect ratio, I think, does a great job in kind of emphasizing a desolation. Because this was a very low-budget movie. I believe it was made on something like $100,000, which is not a whole lot of money now, and certainly was not a whole lot of money. I mean, it was probably, quote-unquote, more money back then, but $100,000 is still not a whole lot of money to make a feature-length film, says the guy who has never made a feature-length film. But $100,000 is not a whole lot of money when you think about it. And so he wasn't working with a lot of top flight grade A actors. He certainly wasn't working with a top flight production crew. Certainly many of the people that he worked with in terms of the crew, were thinking of the script supervisor, Deborah Hill, who would go on to be a co-writer and producer with him later on. Production designer, I believe, also editor Tommy Wallace, who would also work with him later on. And some of the actors as well. I'm thinking Nancy Loomis and Charles Cypher, who of course you will know as Annie and her police officer father in Halloween 1 and Halloween 2. I know that she's dead in Halloween 2, but you do see her corpse. So a lot of the people that he worked with here were going to be his collaborators later on. But he was a young guy, you know. He hadn't really proved himself yet, and so he had to work tight. He had to work long hours, and I believe they worked through Thanksgiving making this movie, shooting for 20 days. And yet, despite those insurmountable or seemingly insurmountable odds, Carpenter kind of uses what he doesn't have, or uses an absence of things to kind of supplement and influence the film that he's working with. So in some of the, not the very opening scene, I'll get to that in a little bit, but in some of the opening scenes when he's kind of showing Los Angeles, or at least the section of Los Angeles where this film is taking place, you get a sense of, with just certain shots, like the camera panning across kind of an empty, barren field, or wide camera shots of a car driving down the street or driving down the road. You just kind of get the sense by seeing this huge screen filled up with nothing, with no people, with barely any cars, with no signs of life, and with dead and dying grass and unpaved or cracklingly paved roads and just gravel everywhere. You just do get the sense of desolation, of a city that is crumbling, which is supplemented by certainly some of the expositional dialogue you hear from I believe it's the police chief or the police commissioner on the radio, kind of talking about the gangland violence which is going on. That stuff in alone isn't enough, you know. Just hearing the police officer talk about it on the radio, and then kind of seeing this group of, I believe they are credited as cholos, but these group of gang members who are descending upon this police station. That's really the only sense we have of, or at least visual sense. Explicit visual sense, I should say, sorry, of sort of, oh my God, look at how terrible Los Angeles is. But you have those things on the surface, or at least you kind of have those things kind of in your face things that are kind of like, look, here's, I'm showing you how bad the crime is. I'm telling you Los Angeles is in a shitty position here in the 1970s. But then you kind of step back and you kind of look around and you kind of see how Carpenter's shooting the city and the certain parts that he is choosing to shoot and when he is choosing to shoot them. And you do, and it forms this fully fleshed picture of, oh my God, yeah, this is a city which is in really bad shape. And it's not just the crime, but you kind of get the sense that the crime is a response to this crumbling infrastructure that they are living in. So that's really impressive. But then the characters, I mean, the writing in Assault on Precinct 16, Assault on Precinct 13, that's going to be rough for me. I had trouble writing the word precinct all day today when I was trying to take notes on it, because it's one of those words that even when you spell correctly, it doesn't seem like it's spelled correctly, and I hate that. Like separate and desperate. When I spell both of those words right, it doesn't seem like they're spelled right, but I digress. But the characters that he writes are, at best, very strong archetypes. I mean, the film kind of, it is an ensemble piece, but certainly many of the that ensemble is graphically blown away, and some rather quickly. But so the film kind of really revolves around two characters, or at least focuses on two characters. Or if you were going to say that there are two main characters, you'd probably say that they are Ethan Bishop, you know, kind of the young up-and-coming police officer who is charged with watching over this precinct in this what is supposed to be an uneventful overnight. And then Napoleon Wilson, who is the hardened criminal, you know, the man who is not headed for death row, but is certainly on his way towards what is sure to be a lifetime prison sentence. Those are the two characters, and you kind of, I don't know much about who they are as people, which isn't to say that I need to know Ethan Bishop's backstory, or I need to know exactly what it was that got Napoleon Wilson to a point where he's going to be in chains for the rest of his life. But I don't know, I guess for the purpose of emotional investment, I feel like I needed a bit more depth to them, to the sense of, like, maybe if there was even, you know, maybe if there was a shot of Ethan Bishop kind of kissing someone goodbye before he got in the car to drive off to what he assumed was going to be an uneventful day at work, or maybe if there was some history between Napoleon Wilson, one of the convicts that he was with, we could have gotten the sense of, okay, then there's more reason for me to care about why these people make it through the night, other than just the sense of, well, I hope they make it through the night because they are people as opposed to the faceless hordes which are coming at them, which I want to root for someone because they are a someone, rather than just, well, I guess I should root for them because I hate the people who are trying to attack them. Because Carpenter makes it very clear these characters who are attacking the precinct are pretty shitty people. Which leads me to the discussion, and it's not even so much a discussion, but the scene where that little girl is killed. Holy shit, man, I did not expect that. I did not expect that would happen. I mean, certainly when this little girl and her father are introduced, you kind of get the sense of, like, okay, this is going to be set up for something. There's something bad is going to happen to these people, or at least Carpenter is going to show or imply that something bad will happen to these people. And what we get instead is a little girl getting shot in the chest with blood splattering all over her, cold-blooded shot in the chest. This guy does not give a fuck about this girl. Shoots her, then just repeatedly shoots this ice cream man that's on the ground. Yeah, these are bad characters. These are absolutely bad characters. And I mean, not to say that there was anything too graphic about the little girl being murdered. It just came out of nowhere. I mean, you kind of get the sense that, or at least I kind of got the sense that little kids are safe on film, right? I mean, nothing is going to happen to little kids. And so when that happened, I kind of did a double take. Like, I can't believe I just saw what I saw. And so it was very effective, I guess, in the sense of kind of making me realize, okay, I am watching a movie where no one is, in theory, is safe. But then it's also sort of a cheap, not cheap, but sort of a thin narrative device to get this father to try and enact his revenge, and then that gets the gang chasing after him, and then gets them to the ultimate, you know, point of where the precinct where the assault is going to take place. So it's like it's a shocking but thin narrative device, and it struck me as a little immature. And I wonder if that's supposed to be on purpose, because I say these things about how these characters are paper thin, and so it's just, it's Assault on Precinct 13 essentially is just kind of about pulse-pounding, is a pulse-pounding action movie for the most part. It is, I don't believe that there is anything, or that Carpenter intended political commentary to come out of L.A., or L.A., out of Assault on Precinct 13, other than maybe a sort of tongue-in-cheek attitude, which I'll get to in a little bit. But, I don't believe Assault on Precinct 13 is supposed to be making a grand political or racial comment, which Reed very much seemed to echo those sentiments as well. But it seems that way because it's like the gang is certainly made up of, well, actually that's the thing, the gang is made up of a whole bunch of different races. It's not just a black gang, it's not just a Hispanic gang, there's all sorts of people, so it's almost like it doesn't focus too much on one race or ethnicity or, you know, group to kind of make it seem like a condemnation on these kind of people. It's sort of everyone. It's sort of like a condemnation on Los Angelinos in general. And then inside the precinct, you have Ethan Bishop, who is an African American, and then you have Napoleon Wilson, who is a Caucasian American. But the race never becomes a thing. You know, it's never one person hurls racial slurs, another one, or you never get the sense that Bishop is trying to prove himself in the face of a white contingency or white constituents, I should say. Constituency, that's what I was looking for. It just sort of is. It just sort of, you know, the fact that he is black and he is white, it just sort of is. And I kind of appreciated that. I kind of appreciated the fact that Carpenter wasn't trying to make a big grandiose statement. He was just kind of saying like, hey, I wrote this character and the guy who was best for it was this guy. I don't care. I don't give a shit if he's black. I'm just going to give him the part because he's the best person for this part, and that person is the best person for this part. And I kind of appreciate it. It was just sort of like this thing of like, hey, this is a shitty situation, or at least Los Angeles is in a shitty situation, and everybody's being affected by it. This is a thing which, and I know, listen, I'm not ignorant to the fact that recessions and certain political and social happenings primarily affect some racial groups more than others. But I sort of see it as sort of not a diplomatic thing, but just as Carpenter kind of being like, listen, if the city is in a shitty thing, if the city is in such a bad state, it's going to affect everybody. It's not, you know, it's all of our problems, essentially. That's kind of, if there is kind of a message that I saw that can be derived out of it, I kind of saw it as that. And the fact that there is, in a way, it's sort of a racially agnostic, I actually sort of appreciated. It's just like, hey, there's, whether you're black, white, Hispanic, Asian American, whatever, when things are shitty for everybody. And also kind of helps that, like, helps extend the way that when things, you know, start working out, when they have to work together, it's just kind of like, well, of course we're going to work together because we're all in this situation now. We have to work together if we're going to survive this night. So I certainly appreciate that. But I think the fact that it is just, or it seems to be just sort of a pulse-pounding kind of action movie, seems like it's maybe sort of building on this idea that what Assault on Precinct 13 essentially is a kind of a glorified or up-jumped B-movie. And I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing, because I think, if anything, it kind of gives a little bit more credit to Carpenter in the sense of he knew the budget that he was working with, he knew the timeline that he was working with, he probably essentially knew, you know, the audience of that day, of that era that he was in. You know, the 1970s were a big era, probably the biggest era for exploitation type of movies, for B movies, for those midnight movies. And so it's kind of like maybe he wanted to tap into something. So what he does, instead of trying to make a grandiose political statement or a grandiose social statement, what he just does instead is tries to make a thrilling, entertaining movie that will tap into some type of draw to viscera that audiences seem to be having, that audiences, especially audiences of B movies, wanted to see in those days. And so I think there's something that's, if not admirable about it, there's something that is certainly intelligent or smart about it, recognizing that he doesn't have a whole lot to work with, so he has to do whatever he can to try and, you know, make his money back, you know, make his mark, kind of show that he is a filmmaker that is young and exciting and can tap into something. And I also wonder if that if he was indeed trying to play, or I should, let me step back on my, I'm tripping over my own words here. Further kind of adding evidence to that idea that this may be just a glorified B movie is how funny Carpenter makes this movie. And that leads me into this idea of sort of, if he was making any kind of statement, if it was supposed to be a tongue-in-cheek statement, because there are parts in this movie which are very funny. And there's three things which really come into play with me, two which are very explicit and one which is sort of overarching. And I'm thinking of Napoleon's kind of running gag about anybody got a smoke. Not just the fact that it is a running gag, but the times in which he chooses to reintroduce that into, that's very funny. There's a specific extended sequence of shots, which once the gang kind of descends on the precinct and they're all just firing in there. I'm talking the most egregious waste of ammo I've probably ever seen on film, because they are just shooting at nothing. They're shooting at walls, and they're shooting at, because everybody's ducking down and typewriters are exploding and bullets are hitting walls and papers are flying everywhere. And there's sort of this extended sequence where you're just kind of seeing nobody's moving, but these people are still shooting. You're just kind of seeing papers jump up and shit like exploding and jumping everywhere. And it's right as when you think it's almost dying down, it starts back up again. And then there's kind of a brief pause in it. And then there's one more shot where something jumps up. And there's something inherently funny about the timing of that sequence. It just seems like it goes on too long. And it seems like it's just, come on, let's get this over with. And it seems very, very silly, basically. And it seemed like there was something intentional about that, because that also ties into I guess this other the over the top violence in this movie, and not over the top in the sense of brain dead Dead Alive. That was the movie I'm thinking of, the Peter Jackson movie Dead Alive. Not over the top in that sense, or even over the top in the sense of Tarantino's Kill Bill and the fight with the crazy 88s with Uma Thurman, in the sense of like, oh my god, the copious amounts of blood, like this, you know, the human body doesn't contain that much blood, but there are so many people being killed in this movie. I believe the final body count is something like 59 people, so let's round it up and say 60 people. There are 60 people, gang members and cops included, who are killed in Assault on Precinct 13. 60 people being killed in a 90-minute movie. And so I think if my math is correct, which it's entirely possible it's not, but I think if my math is correct, that means that there was a person killed every 1.5 minutes on average in Assault on Precinct 13. Most of them come in that initial attack in which people are trying to bust in through the windows, and it's just boom, boom, boom. It's just like back to back to back to back, people being shot and killed. And it's not gruesome, it's not graphic. There's actually not a whole lot of blood. This is very much like independent, low-budget blood in regards to this movie. But it's a lot of deaths, man. And the way that he shoots and edits it together, that sequence, is just like, it's excessive, man. It's just like, it's pummeling you over the head with these deaths, one after another after another. And it's so rapid, and it's so... it's so much that I found myself laughing. And I guess, you know, some people could say that and be like, well, that shows that this is, that he's a bad filmmaker, that he's an inexperienced filmmaker, because you're laughing at something which is supposed to be serious. And I'm not sure how serious it was supposed to be honest with you, because here's what I'm thinking. So yes, obviously John Carpenter is a guy, as Reed established, John Carpenter is not ignorant of the world in which he lives in, the kind of people that surround him, and the attitudes towards the world that those people have. Now, he was a young progressive guy. I'd like to consider myself a young progressive guy as well. Not as young as I used to be, but still young. And I come from an environment in which is a largely white, suburban, older. And I know what their view of the world was. I kind of know the attitudes they had towards urban environments, the fear that they had towards entering the city. Some people I know from back home will never come and visit me where I live because, listen, I don't live in a bad neighborhood, but everyone assumes that, or not everyone assumes, but some of the people I know from back where I came from assume that Brooklyn, everywhere in Brooklyn, is like the Brooklyn of the 1970s. You know, it's just there's gangs are running rampant. It's like the Warriors all over the place. You know, gangs are constantly fighting each other in the streets. There's fires all over the place. You know, police are it's under martial law all over the place. People kind of assume that. They don't say that explicitly, but I know that based on some of their attitudes and opinions they've expressed in the past, that's sort of how they view the world. Now, I see that as nothing but absurd. And I have to imagine that being a young guy living in Los Angeles, Carpenter probably knew a lot of people like that. Carpenter probably knew a lot of people who were thinking, man, Los Angeles, I mean, it's like a war zone there, right? Like, it's got to be, like, terrible. I mean, you know, like, gangs are taking over the streets and, you know, no one is safe and little kids are getting killed when they're going to get ice cream. And he probably, and if he knew those people, I have to believe then he also kind of just extracted that to its points of, like, this is absurd. So what he's doing with Assault on Precinct 13 is yes, making something that's pulpy, making something that's exciting, making something that is thrilling, but I think also something which is sort of, to such an extreme, kind of poking fun at those things that people are afraid of. Like, hey, you're afraid of urban areas? You're afraid of Los Angeles? Yes, absolutely. Look at how terrible it is here. You know, people are getting killed at, you know, one person every 1.5 minutes here, and little girls are getting shot all over the place, and it's just gangs are roaming the streets, and even the police are not safe. And there's just something, I think, which is sort of satirical or tongue-in-cheek about that. That here's a young progressive guy making a movie confirming everybody's fears to the extreme in a way to kind of say, like, you people are absurd for thinking that this is what the world is like. So if that's what you believe, that's what I'm going to show you, because there's no convincing you otherwise. I don't know if that's, I don't think that's, that doesn't seem to be explicit on screen. That is, I think, probably just subtext that I am bringing to the film based on my own experiences, based on what I saw in the movie and what I see in real life. And I could totally understand if people push back on me on that. But that's just kind of what I saw, knowing what kind of person Carpenter is and knowing a bit about the world that he was living in at the time. You know, one of the things that Reed talked about was Carpenter has an attitude of you know, sort of the anti-authority. I didn't see that as much here. I mean, in this movie, that the cops are very much the good guys to the most part. You know, you have the warden and is it... the Charles Cypher character, whose name is escaping me, Starker, I think it is. He's a little bit of an asshole. But the cops as an institution in general are sort of the good guys. To the most part, because this... I talked about getting back to it earlier. The scene that starts this movie is a scene in which a bunch of young gang members are mowed down by police officers in a hail of shotgun fire. In the scene immediately after that, the police commissioner on the radio is talking about it as a shootout. But a shootout implies that there is fire and then return fire, that there are two sides involved. But very much what we see instead is essentially a massacre, is six young members who, yes, are armed, six young gang members who are armed but who are mowed down by the police without... I don't necessarily want to say without provocation, but they didn't really stand a chance. And the police, the next day on the radio, say it was a shootout. And yes, unfortunately, police officers are having to essentially slink to more extreme levels in order to combat this growing gang threat. So I suppose the argument could be made that what starts out this film, what kicks off this film, what incites the gangs to make this sort of blood pact with each other is a scene of excessive police brutality, of police murder. You could make that argument. I think I could understand that. I could also understand the opposite to it. But that's kind of what I saw of what would eventually blossom into a young or younger John Carpenter unfolding his anti-authority wings, if you will. And now having said all this and kind of talking about how it's a bit uneven and how certain things I didn't respond to and certain things I did and how I have this weird reading of it, having said all that, I want to close on the idea that I can totally understand, even if I didn't love Assault on Precinct 13, I can totally understand, having seen it now, how this got him the job writing and directing Halloween, because he does have such a firm command on environment and mood and tone. Like I said, the fact that, yes, there's a bunch of people trapped inside of one small claustrophobic space like Night of the Living Dead. The fact that he does show kind of this, what is supposed to be this crowded urban sprawl as sort of a desolate wasteland. And the fact that you do have, kind of the clock kind of gradually counting to later on in the night, and you kind of have this sense of impending doom. That's all just a few steps away from making a horror film. You make those gang members zombies, or you make them werewolves, or you make them vampires or something. It's a step away from being a horror film, Assault on Precinct 13. And the fact that he did such an effective job on a tight timeline and a tight budget, I totally see, based on Assault on Precinct 13, how somebody at a studio or somebody or some producer said, you know what? I want this John Carpenter guy to make this horror movie. I think he'll do a good job. And we all know how that turned out, of course. So I get it. If nothing else, I'm happy that I saw Assault on Precinct 13, because it's like, hey, I saw the roots. I saw that big step, which eventually got him to make one of the greatest horror films, one of the most influential horror films of all time. And if we didn't have Halloween, we wouldn't have The Thing. But of course, if we didn't have before that, if we didn't have Assault on Precinct 13, we would not have Halloween. So I have to be grateful for what this spawned, where this came from. And yeah, there's some things about it that I really liked. If you want to watch this again, Assault on Precinct 13. See, I told you I was going to be having trouble with this. Maybe it's all the S sounds that keep tripping me up, but it is super easy for you to do so. I tweeted about this last night, but I have mentioned on this show before the streaming service Shudder, which is a horror-centric streaming service. It's only like $4 or $5 a month. If you are a genre fan, it's totally worth your time. And if you have subscribed to Shudder, then you would know that Assault on Precinct is free to stream there. If you actually go to Amazon, if you want to try and watch it on Amazon, if you don't have a Shudder subscription, or, well, hang on, let me step back. If you go to try and rent it on Amazon, you certainly can rent it. You can rent it and purchase it on Amazon. But if you have either a subscription to Shudder or Showtime already, you can watch the movie for free. So because I have a Shudder subscription, I watch the movie for free. If you don't have either of those, like I said, Amazon rent or stream, iTunes rent or stream, Vudu rent or stream, you can also watch it for free on Vudu. The caveat being you have to watch it with ads, so do with that what you will. And also available on the PlayStation and the Microsoft Store for purchase or rental for our PlayStation or Xbox users. So plenty of places you can get a hold of it. And oh my god, I should say this, the quality of the streaming quality of Assault on Precinct 13, god damn it, on Shudder is fantastic. It is so crisp. It is so clear. It is so absolutely wonderful. I highly recommend. I can't recommend Shudder enough if you are a genre fan, specifically if you're a horror fan. But I mean, it's fantastic, the streaming quality on that. So kudos to Shudder. Kudos to a friend of mine, Sam Zimmerman, who is one of the curators there. Check out Assault on Precinct 13 there. If nothing else, I'm glad that this episode is coming to an end so I can stop struggling over saying the words Assault on Precinct 13. Anyway, of course, I always want to hear what you have to say about this podcast episode, this podcast month, this podcast in general. What are your thoughts? Easy enough to get them over to me. Shoot me an email at youdomoviesbadly@gmail.com. Find I Do Movies Badly on Facebook. Find me, Nolan Fixes Teeth, on Twitter. Go to iTunes or battleshippretension.com to catch up on back episodes of I Do Movies Badly. And also go on my Facebook page and check out some back episodes of Fear of God from Reed Lackey. You'll see that the podcast is, yes, it's largely about movies, but there's also other horror-related pop culture on there as well. He's a great guy, a very enthusiastic guy. You should check out those episodes. Okay, I'm really going to end this episode now because I'm tired of the verbal gymnastics which are going on inside my mouth. So that was my episode on Assault on Precinct 13. Be sure to tune in next week where I'll be discussing John Carpenter's Escape from New York, which is much easier to say, and where hopefully I will be just a little bit less ignorant.
This program is a proud member of the battleship Pretension Fleet.